Why don't you start, Alan?
Thank you. Question to Anne. A fascinating talk, but she was onto a problem she saw in terms of evolution being driven by natural selection, but at the developmental stage, in terms of collective intentionality, which was the final human stage you were discussing, you said that natural selection wouldn't work, and therefore it needed something else, as I understood you. Since we're on the level of cultural intentionality or cooperative operation, isn't there a familiar process of cultural selection where people learn and, I mean, do all the things you do in a human culture, and success in that brings its own rewards, and there you don't need a natural selection, a genetic selection, physical selection, where you're at that level.
I certainly don't think you need a genetic explanation at the level of person. Eileen sent me an email, maybe she sent it to many people just in the last week.
Sorry, I can't quite hear.
He's telling me about a meeting which was going to...
Closer.
Angle it towards your mouth. Ah, yes, sorry. A meeting that was going to take place at Reading that we might be interested in, and the title was Persons and Other Animals. And I almost cried. I didn't cry. Persons are not animals. Homo sapiens are animals. And persons and Homo sapiens are different entities. And that's a problem which I think has affected all of our thinking ever since Darwin. He obviously didn't mean to do that to us, but... because his theory, the idea of evolution had been around for centuries. Even some of the ancient Greeks had got onto some hold of it. But what was novel about his position was that he gave us a mechanism. He said, he and a few others at the time, natural selection is the mechanism which enables this to happen. Now, what I think has happened since then is that when people are talking about humans, when we're talking about ourselves, we talk about ourselves as animals because that's clever, you know, that's what Darwin told us to think of ourselves as being. But we forget, or very frequently it seems to me, the sciences that deal with persons and the sciences which deal with the biosphere forget that actually you need a different science with a different methodology and a different aim, even, to talk about persons. You need the social sciences, and they're very underdeveloped, of course, they're in infancy. But we mustn't rely on evolution to tell us about persons. Evolution can tell us about Homo sapiens, it can't tell us anything useful about persons. So if we get specifically to your point, I mean, I think I hinted at the end, a bit optimistically, that I have got a proposal. It's something I'm trying to write about at the moment, about what the mechanism that we need to do for development what natural selection has done for evolution. And of course you have to first of all insist that they're separate things, which I do. And that proposal would be making use of the fact that many folk have pointed out that both genetics and linguistics, both languages I should say, and gene systems, are discrete combinatorial systems. So they've got the discreteness, the combinatorialness, and the systematic things in common. And what I would be trying to argue is that it's the cut-off. I rather cheekily think of it at the moment, I wouldn't dare put it down like that on paper. I think of it as cultural election, because you're just following the natural selection metaphor, as being that which means that persons are as determined as anything else. I don't think that the idea that there's just one little thing in the whole universe which has got free will. I think we're as determined as everything else. But not at all by biology. We are determined linguistically. I think a person is. It's linguistically structured experience. So, when Bob was saying, talking about the way in which we're determined by, oh, I think you said influenced by. You nearly said determined.
Sorry?
Speed up a bit, yeah. Sorry. Oh, speed up a bit.
Wait. I'm not good at that.
When Bob was talking about a person being somebody who has all this experience, and it's that experience which is speaking, what I'm trying to argue is it's not that we have experience, that a person actually is experience. And therefore what I'm saying now is just what this particular Homo sapiens has experienced across 76 years coming out of his mouth. Determined as anything else, but not by genes. Determined by the combination of morphemes, you know, formings into morphemes, which is analogous, but not the same. Sorry, that was too long. I'll try.
Peter?
Following actually directly on that, happily, that you might consider Chomsky's model of principles and paradigms, in that this, the principles, under his analysis, are genetic, are rationalist, they are inherited, the paradigms are learned, but they are only learned on the basis of the principles. To my mind, the interesting thing about that is that our science derives principles from paradigms, whereas what he's saying is that we learn language by using the principles to develop paradigms. So this is a reflexive, cyclic process.
I could respond to that, but maybe I shouldn't. Can I?
Well, help yourself.
Not at all.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. I'm not good at lollies, you know. The person who put me onto Tomasello is a member of my family who works with him in Leipzig, and she does the children and he does the apes. And she gets beside herself with Chomsky. And it's not only one developmental psychologist, there's a whole school of thought within developmental psychology which says, for heaven's sake, save us from Chomsky. Why? Because he mixes up, as I think we all tend to mix up, the biosphere with the world. The biosphere, the organic stuff that lives, which came about, whatever it was, 3,000 million years ago, it does use evolution as its developmental process. But the world, which is the interhuman, perhaps Jean, who is the McMurray expert in the room, might comment on that. Sorry, that's a name. Does not. And these people who are working on trying to understand why it is that apes haven't developed human cultures, if they listen to Chomsky, which they try not to do, they put their hands on their ears, what he is telling them is that really a person is just an animal, and they don't like it, they won't wear it. Their own experimental work suggests that this is nonsense. That's not a very satisfactory answer, I'm aware of it.
Sure, Chomsky would disagree. Anyway,
does anyone want to answer that?
Can you come in?
No?
Okay,
Jonathan.
Thank you. A question prompted by two of this morning's speakers. The stuff about the nudging and priming of the mind that Bob introduced us to is, of course, very disturbing when you consider it in isolation. But I wondered whether it isn't in fact just a sort of byproduct of that same rich cultural apparatus that enables us to think so productively in the first place. The sort of shady slums around the huge great metropolis of real thinking.
Yes, I think one of the points that Kahneman makes is that the system one, which is, has all these unreliable things, is in fact most of the time jolly useful and culturally vital. It's just that it does lead as a sort of byproduct to all kinds of cognitive biases which cause us to make bad decisions or think wrong. So yes, the book tends to concentrate on all those bad things, but actually, probably 95% of the time, it's a good thing. Is that more or less the sort of thing you were asking?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would just like to add to that, I would express my complete agreement with Bob. The example he gave us about the bank teller and bank teller who is also a feminist, I'm a French statistician. I fell for that one nevertheless. The biases are immense.
I think it's easy for me to shout.
Okay, right. I didn't understand the mechanism of that thought experiment. And I wondered, what do you do? You present to... Do you have to put in an order, Linda the bank teller, and Linda the bank teller plus feminist activist? What do you have to do?
Well, the test was to put those, I think about eight things, in order of probability. And of course, a lot of it is just irrelevant. The only relevant thing was hidden in there were these two things which have to go in a certain order. You have to put bank teller as higher up than bank teller who's a feminist, simply because bank teller includes within it the smaller subsection of bank teller's a feminist. That's all.
I'm not sure this shows cognitive bias so much as confusion when you get these kind of tests. You're trying to work out what are they trying to get out of you. I think it's very easy to get these things wrong, and I don't think that the interpretations that one puts on the results of these kind of searches are necessarily that reliable.
When I read that, I thought, I bet what people are thinking is that if Linda is bank teller, then she is a feminist bank teller. and that little argument led to them choosing the importation of the if-then.
I was going to make a comment. The only comment... The comment that I would make is that we can't possibly know everything in this world because the world is just too big. The important thing from the point of view of survival is to be near enough right, often enough, and quickly enough. So not to be caught out is about most of the thing. So these devices, these biased thinking and so on, the test is not are they deductively correct, but are they effective?
Ivor.
Right, not entirely sure I understand my own question, so we're in trouble. does this irrationality, the cognitive flaws, the biases, the prejudices, and the strange attractors, does this place a bomb under Kantian rationality?
Thank you. The expert on Kant, I'm not actually. I don't think you can. Well, I would think it's because Kant saw that he developed his concept of rationality to get away from the fact that, as he puts it, even all the biases in this make it almost impossible to be rational. I think there are other ways of putting a bomb under Kant's concept of rationality, which don't involve all that. But I can't say that I've read the Critique of Pure Reason yet. Read the other one. So I'm not going to make any further comment on Kant.
Anyone else like to comment? No, you've silenced my
Yeah, I really enjoyed Bob's talk. I wanted to introduce the idea of post-hoc rationalisation as well, and you talked about how you might judge if somebody is rational and decide on the process or the outcome. Well, it could also be a third, which is, can you then explain your reasons? And I'd suggest that is the main way to judge somebody. There was interesting that there are experiments that have been done in the last couple of years that show, for example, you're offered two options and you choose option A, and the experimenter says, so why did you choose option B? And you fool the person into thinking they actually chose option B, and they don't realise then when they explain all the reasons why they chose option B. So there's lots of evidence that actually we make up our reasons after making up our decision. And then there's also the thought that you could judge somebody as being more rational if you do some of that post hoc rationalisation before you actually announce your decision. So you intuit what the answer is, you go through all of your irrational thinking, you decide it should be A, you rationalise it in your head, you check that it works, and then you announce the answer is A.
I'm afraid I'll preemptive on this one, because this is very close to my heart. This is a problem that's bedeviled mathematics for centuries. One of the issues, for example, with Archimedes, understanding of Archimedes, was that we knew his theorems. It's a very complex theorem, but we did not quite understand how he got there. He would state a proof, but he would not state what led him to that proof. And it wasn't until very recently, I don't know if you read the book called Codex Archimedes, which is a phenomenally interesting book. I highly recommend it. And it was only there that we suddenly got a glimpse of him actually getting to the statement he is then proving post factum as theorems. And this is endemic in mathematics. And the really fascinating thing about this, I know this is, I'm branching away from the subject, but I think it would interest you. The really interesting thing is that it transpired that Archimedes had conception of, at some level, of concepts which are thought to be completely modern. He seemed to have understood the difference between countable and uncountable infinity, for example. It's a complete bombshell, mathematically.
Countable and uncountable,
yeah.
What?
Infinity. And it is because of this habit of us to post-rationalize that all of that is completely hidden from our view. It is a fascinating subject. Anybody else?
Also want to read on. Okay. I think we haven't distinguished clearly between, let's say, the normative aspect and the descriptive aspect of rationality. So I think that undoubtedly we all endorse that we should be rational. On the other hand, I think what Jim said is very important, that we just can't be perfectly rational because we don't have the time. And so we need to find a trade-off between, you know, living up to this normative ideal and you know, being practical and surviving in the world. And in this context, I just, you know, one reaction to Bob's talk. I think he's right on the one hand, but he's not right, really, because I think with the very idea that we only can, based on the outcome, decide if we have, you know, ex post. Somebody said ex post, or we can rationalize what we did. I mean, this is exactly the way how to explain how we control thinking, because we do a little, you know, thinking steps, so to speak. Then we observe, you know, think it goes in the right direction, then we make it in the next step. So it's like walking. We don't know exactly where we put the food, but we put it somehow, and then we get a feedback and we control, so we go a straight line. And I don't agree then that the smallest step, you had three examples, 7 times 2 and so on. I think there's an additional level, which is like 1 plus 1 is 2, which is not something that you memorize, but you just see it. And there's no smaller rational step, either, you know, we all agree that 1 plus 1, you see that 2, or you just kind of different, you have different rationality. And this means that we cannot, when we think, obviously do the very smallest steps. We need to be bigger steps, otherwise we never reach our destination. And so that might be maybe a very big step, and then okay, we go probably in the wrong direction, we take some risk, because we draw from memory, or we just on intuition. So I think in this sense, I think there's potentially being, let's say, what we really do because of pragmatic reasons, and what we always, you know, have in mind as a normative ideal. Yeah? So I think this distinction may also help. And I don't think that really we don't control, you know, that thinking is uncontrolled. I think it's exactly, you know, what you say, you know, the output is being evaluated is what allows us to control as we go along.
Yeah, that's the feedback argument that Peter Townsend mentioned in the original question, which I quite agree with, yes. But I'm not sure that the control, to say that we're in control, somebody said to me in the break, Stephen, in fact, that when I said that we're not in control of thinking, he says, well, when you say that, who is the we or the I that is not in control? And of course, he's quite right. I shouldn't have said that, because it does imply that there's some homunculus in control, which I don't think makes any sense. I think that the thinking controls us, and the feedback is all part of it. In a rational person, what we call a rational person, the feedback is something that happens. If I'm working out what 10 times 2 is or something, and I, every now and again, I'm going to stop and just check that I'm right so far, but that's something which I can't help doing. I couldn't not do it. So I think I don't think the control is a word I would use at any point here.
You don't want to come back on that.
Yeah. You're right. There's obviously the tendency to have this homunculus view. But I still think that somehow that's a problem, because you kind of have a thought, okay, and then you have a meta thought, so to speak, about your thought, and this is what is the controlling instance, so to speak. This is the way I see it, and probably we talk in the wrong terms somehow. You have to, you know, talk that we control thinking. I mean, we are thinking things, so it's not that there's two things, there's I and the thinking. So this is the same, you know, yesterday the discussion about the dualism that I think it was, I think Peter mentioned this argument that we talk about two things. So, but I still think that there's a way to say that we control the thinking, because we are, at the end, the thinking. Yeah? So that
if I may come onto this, I think you are in a way talking of those purposes. Because what you are talking about, Christian, is a negative control, it's a kind of filter. Whereas what Bob is talking about is initiation of thought before it's being filtered. And I go
up to a point. I noticed the expression meta-thinking or meta-thought there. Now, I can see that under analysis you can say that one thought is a sort of metaphor for thinking about thinking. But I'm sure that the thinking is happening one thought after the other. And when you're thinking about thinking, you're not thinking at a higher level. It's just the thought which comes straight after your other bit of thinking, maybe about that bit of thinking. But that doesn't mean it's higher in some hierarchical sense, except by analysis afterwards. You can think that thought is at a higher level. But it's not really a higher thought or some controller. I think it's just
it's a thought about the thought, right? So the thought has a content, the previous thought. So it's true, it's still a thought, but it's a thought. It's a kind of recursion.
But the levels, I don't think, take place in some logical space in the mind. It's just that when you're talking about it afterwards, you can say that thought is a higher level than that one. But that suggests, I don't think there's a higher level that controls the lower thought in any meaningful sense.
Can I put a little something in here? When you're thinking at the second level, when you're thinking about thoughts, you are attributing different properties. So you're thinking that thought is true, or that thought is false, or that thought is justified, or that thought is not justified. And it's thoughts like that that control your, if it's not justified, I'd better drop it. If it is justified, I don't like it, but I ought to consider it. So there is a control of some kind. And that control only comes in at the, I agree, it's not higher level, thoughts aren't in space.
Can I ask if that could be produced by a feedback mechanism, which is monitoring your thoughts?
Yes, but it's you who's monitoring your thoughts.
I'm thinking of you, as
you're when you're thinking at the higher level.
Your thoughts are actually triggering other feedback mechanism.
Well, you can't have a higher level thought without having a lower level thought. You can't have a thought about a thought without having the thought about which you're thinking.
Yes.
I shouldn't have possibly come in there, because now loads of other hands have gone up, and I told Peter ages ago it was his question next. So I'm going to put Frank and I'm going to put Jean on the list. Peter.
Okay, well, it's a question about category mistakes. Being a Christian, but anyone who's waited. I asked a question yesterday, and this is a kind of extension of it. Yesterday, Christian outlined this story about category mistakes, that you have sentences, and then you formulate propositions from them, and then you have context in which they're used. And that roughly, he was arguing that the category mistake comes where you can't formulate the proposition properly. And I was defending the view that if you need to work harder, because you can if you really make an effort. It just strikes me that the best thing to do is to actually focus on the label, category mistake. If it's a mistake, it has to be meaningful. If you're going to say it's meaningless, then it comes up like Dora's description of not even wrong. To qualify as a category mistake, I'm trying to think it has to be meaningful. But my question is that if I think about, I've got three possible category mistakes here. One is the Gilbert Ryle thought that the mind is an object, and the proposal is that's really stupid, the mind isn't an object. Then a very simple one, dolphins are fish, which seems to have got them in the wrong category, and then two is green, is the one that Ofra Magidor uses. In each of those cases, it seems to me that there is, what's gone wrong is not a failure of meaning. It's perfectly clear what's being said in all three of those cases. They're just incorrect. So you formulate the proposition correctly, and it's just not true that dolphins are fish. For Ryle, it's not true that mind is an object. And if you know anything about two, you know jolly well it isn't green. And so the view I want to just float for you is that category mistakes are about our judgments about the world. They're not. The Ofra Magidor sets an agenda where it's very much a linguistic matter, and the breakdown is all at a linguistic level. And in the context of this conference about thought, if we're going to start looking at thought entirely sort of internally as what goes wrong internally in thought, and category mistakes happening inside the world of thought, you've missed the point, because thought has to engage. You only understand thought when you see it's engaged with the world. And category mistakes is a beautiful illustration, I think, of how we go wrong because we misjudge the world, and it shows up as a failure to formulate propositions or something.
I think it's a very good point. Actually, Magidor, what she holds is the following account of category mistakes. So she, I think, is completely in line with you. She says, well, to say that, the number two is green is perfectly meaningful, and it's simply false, okay? Mm-hmm. And there are obviously more absurd claims than the dolphin is a fish. Dolphin is a fish is just... And here we have the scientific classification. So I would say this is rather a stipulation. Let's say classification on stipulational level. So there's a concept fish in a zoological scientific sense, and the dolphin is just on the fish. But I think we all of us, we could have a concept which is, you know, not so precise, but a common sense concept fish, and dolphin for me perfectly is a fish somehow. Obviously not in the zoological scientific sense. So, but what I want, you know, just, I mean, there are other accounts of cutting mistakes, and you need to account them for the oddness, for the infelicity of certain cutting mistakes, like Caesar is a prime number. And what Magnitor is saying is, well, what we have here is the problem is not the semantics, so it means the truth, the status is something that can be true or false, so, but it is the pragmatics, it means how I use the word. It is something like, she said, presupposition failure. What is it? Imagine someone says, Peter stopped smoking, but Peter never smoked, right? So he gets an oddness because, this sentence, Peter, is it true that Peter stopped smoking? Well, no, it's not true, but it doesn't make sense because Peter never smoked. So the presupposition is here that Peter has smoked in the past. So what Magnus says, okay, a cutting mistake is a presupposition failure, because if I say Caesar is a prime number, I presuppose that Caesar, Caesar is a number, right? This is a number, and I presuppose this, but obviously nobody presupposes this, so it's completely stupid to say Caesar is a prime number, because it's not even a number, right? I try to argue that that it is better to consider that, not, you know, at the end you have to account for the infelicity. Okay, why is it possible to say the Caesar is a prime number? Because okay, it's on the level of semantics, means it's a sentence which has no true value, it's because it's not really achieving to be a proposition. This is one way. And the other way is to move this strangeness into pragmatics and say, well, it's just odd because there's some presupposition, right, that you have to assume. But then you get a lot of trouble on the pragmatic level, so to speak, because you need to have a theory about presuppositions, right? So what is meaningful to presuppose and what's not meaningful to presuppose. And here, what I think is that the whole apparatus of what we presuppose in a normal context is exactly our conceptual apparatus. So our conceptual apparatus encodes these presuppositions. And this means what? Well, why don't move it then and just exclude those sentences that make strange presuppositions? The advantage is that then you can treat a lot of other problems. Like I said, the liar paradox. Because the liar paradox, is it true or false? You say it's false because you must say it's false somehow, no? With this account, you have the possibility to block completely and say, well, no, it's not a prosecution, but it's not true nor false. So the liar paradox solved. Okay. So what I say, I think there's a choice to make. So you can make this choice. Okay, it's something that is false, but then I think the consequences are worse than if you make the choice. Say, well, this is not a prosecution at all. I'm not sure if I expressed myself clearly, but. I think at the end, it's probably not the right or wrong answer, but I'd say what is better in the context of other problems, and if you have a theory which can solve other problems. Also, you need not an additional theory about presuppositions, that it's better to make this simpler, the simpler theory, because it covers more.
Eileen would like to add something. Right. I'm responding not so much to what Christian has just said, but to what Peter said. And I think we were discussing this in the car. And, it certainly seems to me that category mistakes are ontological errors which are encoded in language. So if you say, right, the theory of relativity is listening to breakfast, right? The theory of relativity is an abstract entity. Abstract entities don't
don't do things, but well, they don't do things like listen. They don't. It's a question. You have to get your categories and the properties that go with that categories right. So a category error is just an ontological error. Whereas, I haven't really worked this out, but I wouldn't think that a metaphor is a category error, an ontological error, because you're perfectly aware of what the properties of the things are, and you're mixing them up in an imaginative way, it seems to me. I think there's you know, it's a very interesting topic.
Okay.
Sorry if I've thought this through, but I was just trying to relate the idea of thought as a collective process with the idea of trying to divide between things that make sense and those that don't. So say statements that might be meaningful in some sense but not seem to have any content. And it occurred to me that this whole area of discourse or debate of thought, which some people come along and say, well, actually that sort of contentless, you know, it's meaningless. For instance, I mean, religion might be, for some people might think that religious discourse just doesn't really, in some sense, make sense. And philosophy, for some people, comes into that category, or metaphysics. And, I mean, Hume's famous statements about consigning certain books to the flames, which might have made quite a large amount of his own, or Wittgenstein's idea about some philosophical so-called problems being a misuse of language. And then you get things like some continental philosophy, which for some people have ridiculed as the whole area of discourse which has been developed, and ultimately, is it really about anything? And there was a spoof article which was actually published, thinking it was real. You can Google this. It was at Hermeneutics of Quantum Gravity, and in good faith, a journal published this, and then the author said, well, actually, it's complete gobbledygook. It doesn't mean anything. So I was just wondering whether it's particularly difficult to, if there are sort of like collective, possible collective or patterns of discourse or which to step outside that and to judge our collective thought processes as to actually whether we're saying anything meaningful to each other.
Yes, just before trying to answer that one, when we're talking about dolphins being fish, there is an annual document produced by the Station Office which is called Standard Industrial Classification, and it just lists the industries in the country, and the number one is agriculture, forestry and fishing, and underneath that heading there appears whales. It's not because they think whales are fish, it's because in that context, and context is everything, it makes sense to put whales in with fish. But I have it now, turning to this collective question. I find it interesting and a bit disturbing, I might say, that we're talking in terms of mistakes, errors, irrationalities, a whole load of negative things, to which I could add some more. I mean, in social psychology, there's a long tradition studying what's called conformity and pouring cold water on people who can't think straight enough for themselves, that all they do is conform with what the next person has said, the last person has said. And we're putting all that lot together as negativities. And yet, what the disturbing thing for me, and I still haven't properly thought it through, is that when Tomasello is talking about collective intentionality, and he's talking about the normative aspects of it, those things which mean that we look out for what the next person is thinking because our reasoning must be such that anybody could come to this conclusion, he is actually positively evaluating some of those mistakes, errors, irrationalities, as things which enable us to think as a group. I mean, the whole idea of groupthink was totally negative, wasn't it? But I think we perhaps have to question whether all these negativities are actually so negative. Whether what we're not doing is going in for normative thinking. If I think this line is 3 inches long, but my neighbour next to me in this experiment has just said it's 2 inches long, instead of thinking he's mad, what I say is, well, maybe it's 2.5. And that's an attempt to get to a normative what anybody would think. I mean, it's a disturbing idea, but it's there in terms of...
Can we call that a measure?
No, this is an experiment.
You don't want it anymore?
Yes, I do.
No, not you.
My question has been answered, but well, does it imply? Am I right, Bob, in saying that you're thinking that human beings are using system one and system two? There's a continuum of uses. An individual may one day use a lot of system one and a little of system two, and another day a totally different fraction. And perhaps the clear distinction between system one and system two is misleading in that sense.
I think that's in a way two different things. I think that the Kahneman view would be that we use system one and system two, sometimes one, sometimes the other. My view is that system two is really a subset of system one. I think all thought is associative. What you think is what's been caused by what went before, etc., etc., etc. And whether it's system one or system two, well, as I keep saying, depends on the outcome.
Yeah,
so definitely. Yeah, I think that's all I'll say on that. Other people on the panel who haven't said anything on that too, but I think I want to.
I would say that if thought is a physical process and answers or concepts coalesce or arrive out of the chaos of the answers that are already there, then obviously the concepts that have got into the mass of the brain most recently or highest priority have the strongest connection, as it were. These are the ones that are going to come to the surface in the process of thinking, the next answer that's going to emerge. That makes sense.
Yes, my question concerns the imperceptibility of cues concerning intentionality. In the 50s, I knew an anthropologist called James Woodburn who spent 2 years with the Wasindiga in Tanganyika. He spoke there, he learned their language, he wrote their grammar. So there was no question that he could not understand what they were about. But he said whenever they went hunting, he never had a clue. Suddenly they would get up at 2 o'clock in the morning or 5 o'clock in the morning. It was a leaderless group, well, not entirely leaderless, in that sometimes one person would have the leadership role in different circumstances. So it wasn't that they were following a leader. And he said he never knew, but they all seemed to know. And it wasn't a question they were tapping each other on the shoulder in the middle of the night. They knew this was going to happen. And I've heard it said of the Inuits too, but I don't know. So I think there isn't a clear line in the nature of cues that are given.
It's maybe that I don't understand the question, but I would have thought that the references that you make are to two different groups of people, human beings.
This theory
about joint intentionality, if that's the bit you're talking about, precisely says that it's human beings who can, via joint intentionality, do the sort of things that you're talking about, whereas great apes can't.
Well,
so I'm not sure what
the point I'm making is that the cues of great apes might be as imperceptible as the cues of the Wasindiga.
You mean the great apes might be actually still going in for joint intentionality?
They're just not showing us.
Or we're not able to see.
Yes, maybe want to read Jane Goodall's book again.
Yes. Well, maybe that's the case. But I think the only thing I can say for that is that there is no evidence that that is the case. No evidence that I know that is the case. That they have joint intentionality. In the sense that he is using it, seeing the same situation from a different perspective at the same time. Now, I mean, if you can produce the animal experiments, the great ape experiments, it would need to be, which show you that they can do that, what I would advise is that you send your evidence off to Tom Sowell and see what he says.
Ideally, of course, they wouldn't be experiments. They would be observations in natural settings.
Yeah, okay, well, that even. You know, I mean, if you can explain, if you can relate such stories to him, send the evidence to him and see what he says.
Simon, is it?
Yes. We've had lots of talk about determinism and reason and deduction and logic, but no talk about creativity and where that comes from.
Well, no, I didn't mention the word creativity, but I did mean to imply that when one is not being going along a strictly dug, already dug furrow of thinking, like 2 + 2, that things occur to you. And presumably, what it means to be creative is not to decide to have a creative thought, which I think is logically impossible, but a creative thought occurs to one. And if you live among the right sort of people, or perhaps even you're born with the right sort of brain, I don't know, but there are people who are creative who just seem to have creative thoughts occur to them. And the rest of us think, oh, if only I'd thought of that. Only I'd thought of that Beethoven symphony before he did. So I agree, absolutely vital. And it's not just rational thinking in a systematic, logical way. It is sort of inspiration, things just happening to occur to you, if you're lucky.
Yeah, things, I agree with Bob, things just sort of tumble out and arrive in a state of equilibrium. This, of course, arises out of the apparent chaos within the mind. So it's a question within the brain. So it's a question of a state of equilibrium being reached, that this particular state, this new idea, is a stable state. So it survives as a concept.
I think we touched somehow indirectly on creativity. I think the system one, or was it system two, I don't know what is what, the intuitive kind of machinery, I think is a source of creativity. There are different types of creativity, like in poetry. Precisely metaphors, I think, you know, bringing up certain type of metaphors or stretching the meanings of the words in interesting ways. I think this is creativity. And also in science, creativity is to see the world in a different way. Like, for example, that light is a particle and a wave at the same time. Again, sounds like a category mistake, but at the end, you can make sense out of it. And there's also creativity. So I think from all the talks somehow we can extract some ideas about creativity.
Yeah, I'm not sure that creativity just does come out of the blue necessarily, sunlight, but I think you can get creativity out of very systematic thinking or very systematic working, because by doing that you see new connections. New ideas. I think ideas feed each other. Old ideas create new ones. So don't diss the rationality.
Agreed. I just wanted to come back very briefly to support Bob's words on meta thoughts. I see no hierarchy in the mind. And if you substitute for thoughts propositions, it's one proposition after another. And if you get an argument, which is a sequence of propositions between two interlocutors, to call each subsequent one a meta-proposition, well, you can if you want, but I don't think it helps. But I think that sheds some light on the necessity of this meta-thought business, because otherwise there's this huge hierarchy of the sort of infinite without end. So I just agree with Bob that this meta thinking is rather misleading in its implications.
If I may come to it on this one, because this is something that was very actively discussed in AI circles in 1960s, 1970s, this notion of a hierarchy of sort and meta-sort and meta-meta-sort, etc., was causing terrible confusion, terrible trouble. And in the end, Marvin Minsky cuts through the whole nonsense by saying, forget about hierarchies. Sorts are not hierarchically ordered. Sorts are a heterarchy. In other words, they are a network, interconnected network, but there is no implied higher, 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 higher.
So get away from meta.
Yeah. Right, 1 minute. I'm concerned about the connection of thought to action, and I'm really concerned about climate change, and I'm wondering if there's anything thoughts about thought has to say to get us to the situation where the problem is being energetically addressed.
A quick thought on that is that climate change deniers are a classic example, in my opinion, of people who indulge in wishful thinking, because it is so inconvenient to have to do anything about climate change. There's a huge incentive there to believe that it isn't happening, or it's not our fault, or there's nothing we can do about it. So what's a classic example of one of those cognitive biases?
Well,
like creation is another nice cognitive bias. Evolution is another one, I think. The purpose of thought is to predict the future. And to select those options which maximise happiness. So when we look at climate change, we can predict just how unhappy things would be if we don't do something. And therefore it is a question of getting our case across. So there's enough people of a mind to do something together. But the role of thought is actually predicting what the outcome will be.
The last question, I'm afraid. Sorry, Chris, and sorry, Ivor.
Something about the implications of what we discussed is today, and I very much together with Bob and what Mike seems to be not over inflating the role of rationality, but in addition to something like learning the rules of memorizing the rules of thinking. Do you have any new ideas of how we can improve the quality of things?
Which I did. Partly because I could get money from it. I think the ideas would just have to occur to me, and they haven't.
Well, I think the answer is yes. And the answer is counterintuitive one, perhaps. Let's be a little bit less certain. We keep mistaking our intuitions for facts. They are not.
I also propose to take the new online course from Marianne, Critical Reasoning.
Yes, or buy my book. Yes, I think we can improve our reasoning skills, and I'm sure that's true. I'm afraid that is all the time that we've got, and I don't know if it's up to me to propose a vote of thanks or whether on you is going to do it. I think Bob probably ought to do it.
Yes, first of all, Christian has organised this day, and well, I did not really. Our point is like how successful it is. Anyway, thank you very much. But it would have been a pretty useless weekend if you hadn't turned up as the audience. Well, I think I was still waiting. So thank you all very much for coming. And also, is there any of you who aren't, or isn't, aren't members of the Oxford Philosophical Society? They all are.
I was going to say, you shouldn't be here.
there's some dispute here, but we won't be certain as to whether there are people out there in the audience who aren't members. But if you want to join, come and see one of us, or look up the Oxford Philosophical Society website. You just look up on Google Oxford Philosoph, and you'll find it. And the other thing is that next year there'll be another one of these days, and the more people who volunteer when the invitation comes around to give talks, the better, because then you can make it even better than this year's has been. Yes. So that's an invitation.
And we do want, we'd like to encourage people who haven't spoken before. We'd like to get new faces in. So,
And that's a very good way of ensuring that your name gets known.
Yeah.